Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. There's a popular cliche about facing death. After the initial sadness and fury of being diagnosed with a terminal illness, patients enter a state of grace, filled with serenity and acceptance in their final days. Well, it's a cliche and it's a myth.
Because depression, not serenity, anxiety, not acceptance, are what mark the last days of life for many terminally ill patients. And that's why a small but growing group of doctors are turning to a once shunned class of drugs to help relieve psychological pain at the end of life.
They're turning to psychedelics.
Joining us now is one of those researchers, Dr. John Halperin. He's head of the Laboratory for Integrative Psychiatry at McLean Hospital, and he's led studies on the use of MDMA, or ecstasy, to relieve anxiety in end-stage cancer patients. He was also one of the doctors featured in a recent New York Times article entitled "A Kaleidoscope at the End of the Tunnel." Dr. Halperin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is an enormous topic about how we deal with the psychological distress at the end of life, and I'd like to get into as much of it as possible, but I wonder if we could just start by talking a little bit about how depression and anxiety are currently treated for people who are in the last months or weeks of their life. If I had cancer and I came to my doctor and I said, I'm feeling terribly depressed and anxious and it's taking over what few days I have left, what would a doctor do?
Well, I think for the vast majority of patients, there are medications and treatments that are known to be effective. Antidepressants are effective. Anti-anxiety medications are also effective and may help a really wide panoply, maybe even a majority of patients that would come to us in the doctor's office, but not everybody, and also not as well. Remember, if you've never had depression or anxiety in your life, but then you're given this diagnosis of a terminal condition and you get depressed, if you didn't have that news, if you weren't living under the weight of that lifespan being shortened like that, you wouldn't be depressed. And for a lot of those people also then, it's situational, and antidepressants don't work well. Moreover, anti-anxiety medications cause a lot of other problems. They are over-sedating, they cause memory problems, balance problems, especially when combined with opiate pain medications.
Mm. So this idea that for some people they basically end up in a sedated state rather than some other form of being at the end of life, is that one of the things that drew you to looking at psychedelics as a possible alternative?
That's exactly the point, is that right now the standard of care for a number of patients, they're frustrated that they may have panic attacks when they don't take Valium or Klonopin, but when they do take it, they wind up sleeping through much of their day.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, so that's the current state. I'm sorry, I'm sort of fumbling here a little because there's something that we should state flat out, and that is the psychedelics that were mentioned in the New York Times article and the ones that you work with MDMA or have done research on that, also known as ecstasy.
Correct.
The New York Times article also mentioned LSD. These things are currently illegal. They are not available or shouldn't be available to people, you know, just from their doctor or on the street.
So a very quick history lesson about that. The Controlled Substances Act of 1970 and successive amendments create a scheduling system of drugs. LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, ecstasy, these are in Schedule 1. They are illegal drugs except for research purposes only. So when the Congress enacted this law, it never wanted to shut down the possibility that we could find other medical utility even out of a drug that's most commonly known as drugs of abuse. So currently these are not available. They are illegal except in these tightly controlled research settings.
Okay. So tell me, what is it that you first, what the experiments were that you first did with MDMA or ecstasy?
Well, we go back quite some time with NIDA funding looking at the long-term cognitive consequences of MDMA abuse. So there wasn't much known about pure MDMA users. And we did a very large study that was published a few years ago about that because I don't in trying to calculate risk-benefit profile, we really have to know what we're exposing people to. And especially when we're talking about patients in the most vulnerable stage of their life, nearing their death, we really don't want to be taking advantage of them in an unethical way. They're not to be our guinea pigs. They are held in the highest regard and care. They're always our patients, too. Mm-hmm. So once we've established some evidence that MDMA has a risk-benefit profile that could be useful potentially in this patient population, we proceeded to propose a study, and it goes through many, many layers of review to gain approval for such a project.
So I take your point. You went through the established protocols to be sure that patient safety was held in the highest regard. But then once you received all those approvals,
right,
and you administer, tell us a little bit about the patients who were part of your study and what effect it had on them.
Well, it's unpublished work, so I can't go into the details of it. That's just, but that's a standard Harvard policy. It's not just specific to my work. That's just how we do things here. But I can tell you that that the choice of MDMA, very specifically, its psychological effects that attract a lot of people to abuse it may have utility in the clinical setting. We know, for example, the published work of Michael Midhoffer down in South Carolina working with post-traumatic stress disorder had very promising results, and he's now working with PTSD victims from the Iraq War that have come back, so veterans. And there was earlier work with in couples therapy. So there's been publications about what MDMA does to people. When you're talking about MDMA, that's purified synthetic MDMA, not something we're not taking street ecstasy and giving this to people. Mm. And so that also may be a very important difference. It appears to be very heart-opening for people. And
heart-opening?
Heart-opening. That they're termed empathogens, that they help people get a sense of grace, of self-compassion and compassion for their situation. And in that type of setting, they may still experience and process what makes them anxious, but have the ego strength to take a different look at it, that they can actually bridge these end-of-life issues that they're struggling with and come away with some insights that help them even after the drug has worn off.
Even after it's worn off. Do we understand why? I mean, what sort of chemical processes are going on in the brain that allow sort of this elongated effect to be experienced by patients?
Well, rather going mechanistically, I would just say if you have somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, and end-of-life issues, we're also talking very often about anxiety disorders. Trying to talk about what makes you anxious is going to result in a panic attack. It becomes the elephant in the room that you don't want to talk about because you're going to leave the patient really unhinged because this is the sort of thing that causes them so many problems. But under the assistance of MDMA, the psychotherapy can get to the heart of the matter, and people can feel that they have the ability to talk about it without having the physiological symptoms of a panic attack. They may still express anxiety, but now they're able to complete the mission. And when you're dying of cancer, you don't have as much time as you do in traditional therapy.
Now, is this one of the differences that you believe lies between maybe trying to use psychedelics versus conventional antidepressants? I think I hear you saying that for some patients, conventional antidepressants may end up just numbing them to the reality that they're facing, whereas from what you just said, it seemed like you think that psychedelics or some, in certain cases, actually expand a patient's ability, perhaps.
It's my hope that they would have to turn less often to prescription medications by achieving some conclusion to situations that otherwise feel like these problems will outlive them. Opiates and sedative hypnotic anxiety medications may numb a person, but for some people also antidepressants may just not work because they're not depressed people. They're depressed over the situation that they're living in, and it just doesn't work. Meanwhile, they're dying, their near-term death is still coming up to them, and if we can give them an intense program of psychotherapy in which they're able to really take a sober, serious look at all the issues that are worrying for them, often with their loved ones, that there can be a sense of closure, that they actually get to circle back and feel that they have that the fear that they have about their death at least will not be part of something unanswered for their future.
Dr. Halperin, let me ask you what may sound kind of like a silly question, but how many patients whom you've encountered at the end of life experience that kind of deep anxiety and have great difficulty in knowing what's next, knowing what's going to happen to their family? I mean, how pressing is this need for better psychological care?
And it has to be tailored to the individual, and I think it's universal. So somebody who is estranged from their child, an adult who is has other issues and problems, and the parent hasn't talked with the child for many, many years, maybe through MDMA assisted psychotherapy, both parties are able to communicate about the stuff that otherwise will never get concluded even after the death. Mm. And so the parent may say, I really want to have closure about this, and the child's like, no way. But maybe through this type of therapy, they find words that otherwise they wouldn't be able to reach. Maybe they're able to express their love that otherwise they didn't even know that they needed to say.
But certainly you're open to the criticism that potentially by administering for patients who have gone through these tests and have taken the psychedelics, and while they may feel more liberated and free, they're actually not having a true experience of their life, that it's basically a drug-induced state that, you know, may lead them to, they feel, a greater understanding, but it's not reality.
I leave the philosophical debate to others. As a physician, I want my patients to do the very best in their life. And if they describe feeling less anxiety and less pain long-term, let's work on figuring out the ethics and the physiological mechanisms behind it, but know that we're actually helping people. And let them, in their words, express what it's done for them or not.
Well, I'm speaking with Dr. John Halperin. He's director of the Laboratory for Integrative Psychiatry at McLean Hospital. And he's one of a growing number of researchers who are looking into the use of psychedelics to relieve anxiety and psychological distress in terminally ill patients. So listeners, if you've lost a loved one, or perhaps you're going through this yourself, does the idea of using, say, ecstasy or LSD or any of the psychedelics give you hope? Or do you think there are good reasons why many researchers left this behind in the 60s? And more broadly, what does this research say about the way Americans deal with the end of life as a whole? I mean, could such drugs be a good or bad replacement for medical, financial, and emotional support that's maybe lacking in the way we currently approach end-of-life care? Call us with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, Dr. Halperin, if you'll stand by for just a moment, I want to play a little bit of tape from a conversation we had with somebody last year, because she had a personal experience with her daughter who passed away due to colon cancer. And her name is Marilyn Howell. And I think her story tells a lot about the very strong lure that family members experience when they want to do anything they can to relieve suffering for their loved ones. So Marilyn Howell had a daughter named Mara, again, and she had stage 4 colon cancer and was in excruciating pain in the last weeks of her life. And Marilyn eventually went underground and actually obtained MDMA or ecstasy. And it's a story she tells in her book, Honor Thy Daughter, and we talked to her a little bit last year.
I didn't know how I would get through it myself. And, of course, I would do anything to make it better. Anything. And that included eventually going outside the law.
This might sound kind of just naive, but how did you go about getting the ecstasy? And did you give it to your daughter at home? Or
It was at home, but I wanted a therapist who knew what to do. And I thought perhaps if I put the word out to two generations of people that we might come up with a therapist. And indeed, it took about a week. And we found someone who was willing to come and be a co-therapist with me and provide the MDMA.
So after the first treatment, then, of ecstasy, how did Mara react to it? What happened?
The best thing about it was that it stopped her pain.
Immediately?
No, it takes an hour or two for the drug to take effect. And she was, at that point, unable to get up from her bed for more than a few minutes because the pain would spike. She was able to walk across the street with a friend who was visiting from California and have a conversation, be like her old self, a real person, hearing somebody else's problems. She was able to eat. Her appetite came back. So it was like a respite. It was like all of a sudden she was back to herself again. and out of pain.
While this story is incredible, we also have to remember that what you did currently is still illegal, and
yes,
there was no doctor who was overseeing the process, and there could have potentially been some, you know, dangerous or terrible side effects.
This is why I was very careful about having a therapist who knew something, who had contact with emergency room doctors, who looked at all the drugs she was on. When you've seen your own child suffer day after day after day, the risk that she might end her life a day sooner to have a day without pain just is a moot point.
As a mother, looking at your daughter, what were you feeling and thinking at that moment?
Isn't it incredible that my daughter can have these moments of loving life again? And it gave me something to reflect on when she died. If you don't find a seed of gratitude amidst the tragedy, you have nothing to build on. So even though it was a small part in time of this horrible odyssey, those sparkling moments are what kept me going.
That's Marilyn Howell, author of Honor Thy Daughter, talking about the effect that MDMA or ecstasy had on her daughter's final days. We spoke to Marilyn last year, and there's a link to our full interview with her at radioboston.org. So, John Halperin, when you hear the lengths that Marilyn Howell went to try and procure ecstasy under the supervision of a therapist she would not name because it was not official by any way, shape, or form, I mean, you get a sense as to like the lengths that people will go for any sort of improvement in the treatment of end of life for their loved ones. Is this part of the reason why you're looking at these sort of further alternative therapies?
Absolutely. Marilyn Howell came to me initially. She wanted to do this legitimately, but my study wasn't approved yet. And again, here's her daughter dying. So I think that she's a really unique story, though, that most people won't responsibly do things the way that Marilyn Howell did and have the bravery to write about it afterwards and make it a public thing so that we can have this type of discussion.
One thing we should note about Marilyn's story is that she told us that she ecstasy was basically the drug of absolute last resort for her. Her daughter Mara was literally probably in her final days, maybe weeks of life. So the possible side effects she wasn't so worried about because her daughter was dying. Now, for patients who have been diagnosed with a terminal illness, but their diagnosis may be 18 months, 2 years, whatnot, do you have any concern that the use of psychedelics, it's not widespread by any means right now, but that if it were to be, may not be so good for patients who are earlier in their diagnosis?
As compared to prescription medications that have significant side effects as well, we're talking about, again, every medication has side effects. It won't work for everybody or be helpful for everybody. The idea of doing research and drug development is to identify who a substance will be useful for and the parameters at which it can be safely applied. So when people do this in, you know, underground, illegally, they take a number of risks that certainly doctors do not want to have their patients exposed to, and we think we can do it even better. But look, if Marilyn Howell can achieve such an important, compelling moment for her daughter in her final days like that, what do you think we could do for when physicians who are really dedicated to work with people, just like Marilyn Howell's daughter, if they had this in their medical tool bag? I'm not saying that MDMA or psilocybin should be our first line agent to treat with, but sometimes we need to reach in and go for our second, third, fourth line agent because it's important. It's not just primum nono cari, first do no harm. It's also remember to do some good. Mm-hmm. And that's the motivating force, I think, behind all of us doing this type of work.
Let's take a couple calls. Dee is calling from Fenway. You're on the air, Dee.
Yes, I just wanted to add that having used ecstasy at points in my life, and having had an uncle who had died from liver disease at a point in his life, I think this would have been a very good choice for him. Having known how the effects affected me, how they would have affected him, and how they opened up my brain to be more accepting of things in my life, how it may have helped him. And I think that maybe people are missing that point too. Is that this drug can open up aspects of your brain that maybe someone else outside your body cannot do for you.
Thanks so much for your call, Dee. Let's take another one from Tara, who's calling from Bellingham. You're on the air, Tara.
Hi. I actually was calling because my grandfather had Parkinson's, and at the very, in the last, I'd say, year, he went on traditional SSRIs, and it ended up helping him quite a lot. But my other question is about kind of what I've heard about ecstasy and when I've had it before, the letdown of ecstasy that some people have had. I don't know if that's just with street drugs or MDMA, but I thought it was something that I had a question about. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Tara, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Halperin.
So there is an association of post-use blues in some people. It's my belief through some of the work I've done that post-use depressive episodes are very mild. They last for a day or two. And the people who really have trouble with it are people who have a history of depression in themselves or in their primary family. So that might be a contraindication or something that's really looked at very carefully. And people with Parkinson's disease, as the disease progresses, have a higher incidence of depression to begin with.
Dr. Halperin, let me ask you about the potential criticism that you risk or already have endured in taking up this research, because I understand, I mean, the medical establishment as a whole very actively set aside research into psychedelics after the 60s and the 70s. So what do your colleagues tell you about sort of taking up the cause again?
I think, you know, we get past 30-second sound bites. It's always on the up and up. The people in the most senior levels of academics are very supportive because they remember when these drugs were being evaluated for therapeutic utility. And people who are very unfamiliar with this area may need to have some hand-holding about it. But by and large, once they hear that this is something that's being done is through rigorous science with all the checks and balances that you would hope that it's going to, all of this is reviewed and submitted through FDA, that there's an IRB, that, you know, McLean Hospital has the fantastic reputation that it does because it demands the very best science possible that's practiced. And all those things tend to be very reassuring to my colleagues. In fact, I was invited last year to give grand rounds to the palliative care service at the Massachusetts General Hospital in the Ether Dome, which was quite an honor to me. So I think the people directly involved with palliative care, directly interested in medications that affect how people feel and think, actually are very welcoming hearing that quality, rigorous work is being applied in this area.
Now, in terms of seeing the research expand and possibly even into seeing more widespread approved use of psychedelics, another physician who was quoted in the New York Times article who's doing this research actually said he didn't feel terribly optimistic about it because so many of these drugs are, quote, available in nature as it is. I mean, what's your sense as to the long-term possibilities here?
Well, I confess, actually, you're quoting me. So, without a doubt, this is going to be a very challenging thing because we're not going to get drug development money from Big Pharma. And I think it's very hard to ask the U.S. government, which has very limited funds for something like this, to underwrite. In fact, even my own project had to wrap up early because of inadequate funding. I thought, you know, if you build it, they will come. It took years and years and years to get through all of the layers of approvals necessary, and at the other end, to just wind up not having the funding there, it was quite a shame. So I think that's more of an issue than anything else. If we had the money, I think it will expand, and if it ever gets to be made available to the public legally, it's still going to be done with very tight controls and done to protect life, as we do with everything else. I mean, Schedule II drugs are just as potentially harmful as Schedule I illegal drugs. The difference is that they have a known medical use. This is why cocaine and methamphetamine, for example, are Schedule II prescribable medications. Nobody's saying that in the rare cases where we use them medically that this is somehow encouraging people to go on to drug abuse and getting them off the street.
And what do you make of the question that I asked to listeners, that maybe the problem here is in part not so much what happens at the very end of life, but that through the whole process of caring for terminally ill patients, we're not giving them enough psychological support from the start.
That's a fact. The people who get it, who are trying to do what they can, there's just not enough of them. And we don't have things set up properly for helping people manage these days. And, of course, many patients then living in our society like that are trying to ignore the issues to begin with. And it's also It's a sad thing, but I think it's also changing. Palliative care medicine as a subspecialty within internal medicine and psychiatry is definitely expanding.
Mm. Well, that's Dr. John Halpern. He's director of the Laboratory for Integrative Psychiatry at McLean Hospital, and he's been doing research into using MDMA or ecstasy to alleviate psychological distress in terminally ill patients. Dr. Halpern, thank you so much for joining us today.
What an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
And I should say that the conversation continues at radioboston.org, and one of our listeners, Cotton Manifesto, sent us this tweet. Why the controversy about giving ecstasy to the dying? I say give them whatever they want or need. Send us your tweets at Radio Boston. In a moment, a live sneak preview of a new album from local blues singer-songwriter Chris Smither. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.